Welcome and good evening. It's good to see everybody here. Thanks for coming out on a Friday night. And we're excited to have you here. We're also excited to have Mike here, and I'm going to introduce him in just a second. For those of you who don't know, my name is Phil. I'm the pastor of Faith Community Church that meets here on Sundays. And we meet here Sunday afternoons, and we like to do these lectures periodically during the year. We try to have one of these about once every 2 months or so. And we'd just like to hear, for people to hear a little bit about what's going on either in Prague or the world around us, or talk about a certain issue or topic, and so that's why we're excited that Mike is here. Mike and I are friends, even though he went to University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. We've gotten past that, and now we're friends, and then he became my seminary professor. And so we've had all sorts of relationships and relational issues that we've worked through over the years. But Mike is a great guy, and he got his Master's of Divinity from Westminster in California. Then he went and got his PhD from the University of Edinburgh, and he is currently on sabbatical from teaching. He's a teacher at my seminary, which is Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, in America. And he's on sabbatical because he's been working way too much, doing all of those things. And so now he is focused on one thing, and that is working on a book about the formation of the New Testament. And he's doing his studies at University of Cambridge. So he's a great guy. I love getting the chance to hear him anytime I can. He's also going to be preaching on Sunday as an additional plug. So thanks for being here, Mike. He also has a lovely wife, Melissa, and Melissa's here. And their three children are also here for a few days. They're currently watching Star Wars with our three kids. So we're glad that all of them are here. And so with that, Mike, thanks for coming.
I'm pleased to say that Phil and I are past our relational issues, although during basketball season those tend to come back up again and again. It's good to be with you tonight. So excited to be in Prague and excited to be part of what's going on with Faith Community. And I'm really grateful for the invitation from Phil to come and share with you tonight the topic before us. And the topic before us is a fascinating one. It's one that I think has occupied people's minds for a long time. In fact, I probably need to turn this on. You can hear me in the back. I'm on now, so I don't know if you're picking anything up back there. The topic before us tonight is one that I imagine that you've had an opportunity to think about at some point. But it's a fascinating one that's occupied people's minds for a long, long time. Not just scholars, but laymen. Not just women, but men, not only the educated, but the uneducated, not just people in the business world or in the academic world. People from all walks of life have been fascinated with the question that's before us tonight, and that is the subject of the Bible. What's odd tonight, then, is actually we're going to be spending our time tonight talking about a book, oddly enough, but not just any book, of course. Arguably one of the most influential books in the history of the entire Western world, if not the world history as a whole. Arguably, the Bible has changed humanity one way or another. Millions of people in the world love the book of the Bible, adore it, cherish it, read it, and study it. In fact, a number of people come to mind in this regard. I think of Charles Dickens himself, who wrote many wonderful things in his own right, said this: "The Bible is the very best book that ever was or ever will be known in the world." Sir Isaac Newton also had thoughts about the Bible. He said this: "There are more sure marks of authenticity in the Bible than in any secular history." Napoleon Bonaparte, for all of his things in his life, also loved the Bible. He said this: "The Bible is no mere book, but a living creature with a power that conquers all that oppose it." Now, what's interesting about the Bible, for all its people who have affection for it, also has its detractors. Many people have not found the Bible to be wonderful. They found the Bible to be not compelling at all, worthy of criticism and critique. Many have offered arguments against it. The famous agnostic Robert Ingersoll once declared, "I'm going to put the Bible out of business." You may have heard of the French Enlightenment author Voltaire. He once said this. He said, "Another century and there will not be a Bible on earth." And of course, for hundreds of years, people have been critiquing the Bible and still do. In fact, you may even have picked up some of the recent books, even in the last few years, that have been doing this. Maybe some of you have read Richard Dawkins' recent book, The God Delusion. He's no fan of the Bible, if you've read that book. He has his own critiques, to be sure. One of those, he says this, he says, "There's no reason to believe in the canonical Gospels. All have the status of legends, as factually dubious as the stories of King Arthur, in his Knights of the Round Table. So Dawkins, others in the modern day, all are critics of the Bible. So what do we do with all these criticisms that come forward about the Bible? How do we sort of catalog them and think about them? Well, that's what we'll be doing tonight. Tonight we won't be dealing with all of the criticisms of the Bible. You can imagine there's an endless number of people who've had criticisms of the Bible. We can't deal with all those. So we're going to take the top five tonight. We're going to try to break those down a little bit together and think about those five in order and just talk about those. At least get out of the gate a little bit and how we can respond to these accusations about the Bible. Now, as we do, just one thought before we jump into that fully tonight. And that is, tonight, when you think about the Bible, certainly we'll be looking at it from an academic and scholarly perspective, but it's not just an academic question. When it comes to asking questions about whether the Bible is trustworthy or can be relied upon, there's more at stake than just simply scratching any particular intellectual itch that you might have, or that I might have. But we have to reckon with the fact that in the core message of the Bible are claims, claims particularly made by Jesus of Nazareth himself. And these are not claims that sort of are minor ones, but are enormous ones. So big, in fact, they have to reshape and help us rethink any approach we have to the reliability of the Bible. In fact, Jesus seems to indicate, whether you think he's unique or not, certainly his claims are unique. He seems to indicate that he is the center of all of human history, that something having to do with him controls people's destinies. He makes enormous claims in this regard. So whatever we conclude about the Bible, there's more at stake than simply intellectual issues. So let's jump in. There's five of these things that I'm going to be looking at, five of these sort of major objections to the Bible. We'll just take these one at a time. So let me start with the first one tonight. The first objection is probably the most common objection that you can find in discussions of the Bible. By the way, there's seats up front here if you all are looking for some. And there's a couple on the side as well here if you want to file on up. So, first objection, I think, is arguably the most common objection, and maybe one that you've heard a good bit of time in your own particular life, and it's simply this. The Bible is historically unreliable. The first objection that I hear from people all the time is that you can't trust the Bible to tell real history. Yeah, it purports to tell what actually happened, but we all know the Bible doesn't actually tell what happened in real history. Surely it's been modified, surely it's been changed, surely people have altered the accounts of these things. There's no reason to be sure that the Bible actually goes back to the events they purport to tell about. And so historical objections to the Bible are sort of the number one thing that people level against the Scripture. Can't be trusted to tell us about what really took place in real time and space. Now, that's a sweeping objection. It's an enormous one. You can hardly even begin to address it in one short point in a talk like this tonight. So how can we sort of narrow that down a little bit in our time together? Well, let me just narrow that down to the question of the four Gospels for a moment. Let's ask the question, not just the whole Bible as a whole, let's just ask the question, can we trust the four Gospels as historical documents? Do they give us a reason to think that they can get us back to reliable history about the person of Jesus of Nazareth? Now, that's a big discussion today. And maybe you've been reading up on the Gospels or read some of the most recent works that go on in Gospel studies. There's all kinds of discussions about apocryphal Gospels and non-canonical Gospels, Gospels like the Gospel of Thomas, the most recently discovered Gospel of Judas. And these things get mentioned all the time. So the question is, can we trust the four Gospels to get us back to any sort of reliable history? Well, let me just mention several reasons why I think we can. And this at least will get us a little bit down the road in terms of the historical reliability of the Bible. So several things about the Gospels worth noting here about the historical reliability. And the first is something that I think goes unnoticed most of the time, even though it's well established and across the board agreed upon by scholars that are critical and non-critical of the Bible alike. And it's simply this. The four canonical Gospels that we have in our New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are the earliest sources we possess for the life of Jesus. I'll say that again. They're the earliest sources that we possess for the life of Jesus. Now, you may not know what to make of that particular point, but it's interesting to note that even in the secular realm, amongst critical scholars, this is a point that's almost universally agreed upon. Occasionally, you'll find a scholar that will want to try to put the Gospel of Thomas somewhere in the first century. But across the board, scholars have recognized that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the earliest Gospels we possess. And not only are they the earliest, but they're the only Gospels we possess that come from the first century, that come from during the time of the disciples' own lifetimes, first century writings, the only ones that date to that particular period of time. In fact, the other Gospels that circulated within early Christianity, whether it be Thomas, or the Gospel of Peter, or Edgerton 2, or these other apocryphal Gospels you may have heard about, almost always show dependence on the canonical four, and show that they've actually borrowed ideas from them and copied from them in their own particular extrapolations about what Jesus must be like. And so these four Gospels are the earliest ones we possess. And if the historical rule of thumb that the closer you get to the events you're purporting to record, the more reliable your documents will be, and that puts us in very good stead with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because they're the closest we have to the life of Jesus Christ. But the second thing about the Gospels related to that that gives us assurance about their reliability is simply this. If the Gospels are written in the first century, and they're the only Gospels that were written in the first century, then we have every reason to think that they contain eyewitness testimony. In other words, the Gospels were written during a time period when the people who lived during the events of Jesus' life would have still been alive. Now, that's a pretty remarkable thing when it comes to historical documents. So we actually have a lot of documents from antiquity that purport to record historical events and don't record them at all in the time when they took place. Give me an example. Let's think for a moment about the Gospel of Luke. Let's imagine the Gospel of Luke was written in, say, 500 AD. Now, that doesn't mean the Gospel of Luke is false, but if it was written in 500 AD, would there be anybody around that could say that the things contained in it were either true or false, that could verify the events that were recorded there? Well, of course not. And that's what makes the Gospels unique, is they were in a time period when they were published, so to speak, there were people that were still around that could say, yes, that's what took place, or no, that's not what took place. And there's a sense of internal corroboration in these documents when they're put out in a world where they could be either confirmed or denied by the people around. More than that, we actually have a very good idea of who wrote these books. The names that they bear, we have historical information about. We know who Matthew was, a follower of Jesus. We know who Mark was, a disciple of Peter. We know who Luke was, a companion of Paul in the early church. We know who John was, one of the closest disciples in Peter's life. Now, how do we know these men wrote these books? We can't get into that fully tonight, but I can give you one indication. We have very good reasons to think that, for example, John wrote his gospel. We know this because John himself mentored a particular person in early Christianity by the name of Polycarp. And Polycarp was a mentor to a person by the name of Irenaeus, a very famous church father. And Irenaeus tells us very plainly, the Gospel of John is written by the very disciple of Jesus by the name of John. So it goes John, Polycarp, Irenaeus. That is a very tight historical order because it's every reason to think that those Gospels were written by eyewitnesses in the first century. If so, then that changes things dramatically in terms of whether they can give us historically reliable information because they would have been there. We mentioned a third thing about these Gospels that are important to note, and that is the authors themselves. Because of what we know about them being eyewitness reports, we have every reason to think they're trustworthy. How do we know this? When we look at a writer in ancient world, we have to ask the question, what sort of motives would they have to either make things up or to twist the account or to sort of turn it to their own favor? What's curious about the writers of the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is we have every reason to know that writing these Gospels and believing in things they believe did not, in fact, help them or give them, if you will, sort of extra favor to the government of the day. In other words, we know that this type of activity of promoting the person of Jesus and saying things they said about Jesus was not favorable to them. It did not help them. It did not give them an advantage. No one in that day would have thought to themselves, I'll make up stories about Jesus rising from the dead, and that'll help me improve my life. In fact, the very opposite thing happened to these disciples. We know from historical records that most of the disciples who told the stories of Jesus, many of which who wrote these Gospels, went on to die martyrs' deaths for what they believed. Now, people die martyrs' deaths all the time. That's no doubt about that. But people don't die martyrs' deaths for things that they know they just made up. Things that they know were a lie. More than that, we also have reason to trust these authors by the sheer fact that they sat under some of the greatest moral teaching the world's ever seen. No matter what a person thinks about the person of Jesus, when you read the gospel accounts, you have to be impacted by the fact that this is some of the greatest teaching in the world, moral or otherwise. Are we to believe that these disciples sat under this teaching and moments after Jesus had died, then turn around and become sort of charlatans and hucksters to foist this big lie upon all the world about who Jesus really was? Hard to swallow historically, and it gives us reason to think that these writers would have been trustworthy. Last thing I'll say about the Gospels before we move on is simply this. Some people have the idea, when they think about the canonical Gospels, that there is sort of this big battle in early Christianity about which Gospel would really win out. And we hear about apocryphal Gospels all the time. People have the impression that for hundreds of years, Christians sort of lived their lives, and no one really knew what Gospel to trust, and it really wasn't until Constantine and maybe the 4th century where these things sort of got hammered out and the dust began to settle. But I can tell you that that's simply not how it unfolded historically. What's interesting, when we look at the historical evidence from early Christianity, what Gospels had authority in the early church, it is uniformly from the beginning, almost without exception, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. What's remarkable about apocryphal gospels is even though apocryphal gospels were used occasionally sort of in the periphery in the early church, there was never really any formal decision about the canonical four that had to be made. There was never any major disagreement about these four gospels. From the very start, this was just simply the inheritance of the church. They recognized that these were the four that go back, if you will, to Jesus. And for that reason, there's never really any big discussion about them. That's a remarkable fact historically. It tells you that what you have here is documents that go back into the first century and give us good access to the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, so that's the first question. There's more that can be said there. But is the Bible historically reliable? That's an enormous topic we can't cover tonight fully, but that at least gets us down the road a little bit in that regard. Let me mention a second objection tonight. A second objection in regard to the top five objections to the Bible. And the second is simply this, that the Bible has been changed in its transmission. The Bible has been changed in its transmission. Let's imagine for a moment that we grant that the Gospels give us true accounts of the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Let's say Matthew's Gospel for a moment. Let's imagine that we grant that Matthew's Gospel gives us reliable information about who Jesus was, what he did, and what he said. But then there's a second question that comes up that people have raised. Okay, assuming that Matthew wrote Matthew and gave us reliable information about what happened, how do I know that what I have in my hands today is what Matthew wrote? How do I know that when I open up my Bible today and I look at what's called Matthew, that it's the same Matthew that Matthew wrote 2,000 years ago? How do I know it hasn't been modified along the way? How do I know that it doesn't have been altered by scribes? How do I know there hasn't been so many mistakes in the manuscript transmission that you can have no hope at all of trusting these documents? Now, this is the second question that comes up, and it's a very commonly asked question. So it's not so much a question of, can I believe these documents are historical, but can I believe they've been transmitted and copied for hundreds of years so they get down to us today that I can reliably know that they retain the actual words of the author? That's the question. Now, some of you may have heard of a person by the name of Mark Ehrman. Anybody recognize that name? Anybody heard of the book Misquoting Jesus? All right, some of you may have heard of that book and maybe even read that book. That book has sort of promulgated this idea that the manuscripts in the New Testament are so full of scribal errors that it can't be trusted. That scribes along the way, when they made copies, made mistakes. No doubt this is the case. Whenever a scribe copied ancient manuscripts in the ancient world, they would copy them and occasionally they would make a mistake. Ehrman's argument is there's so many of these, you can't trust the documents, particularly the New Testament documents, to have any reliability at all when it comes to knowing what happened or what these original writers really wrote. Is that the case? Well, just a few comments on the second objection, sort of set the record straight from Ehrman's argument, asking the question whether these documents have been adequately transmitted and passed down over time. Now, Ehrman is a big fan of numbers, and if you've read his book, he likes to talk about how many scribal variations there are in our New Testament manuscripts. And he talks about hundreds of thousands of these. Hundreds of thousands of scribal variations in the New Testament manuscripts. In fact, his famous line is, there's more variations in the New Testament manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. Now, when you hear something like that, you think to yourself, well, that's fairly compelling. How can we trust documents that seem to have been changed so much? There's two things that Ehrman doesn't mention in his particular discussions of these scribal variations. Let me just give those to you tonight to help you understand how these documents were transmitted over time. The first thing he doesn't mention is the nature of these textual changes. One of the things that happens in discussions of textual changes by scribes is often what's left vague is the kind of changes we're talking about here. What kind of changes is Ehrman referring to when he talks about thousands and thousands of changes? Are these dramatic changes that alter the historical texts themselves and have the teaching of the Bible now teach something entirely different from what it did teach before? Not at all. When we look at manuscripts in the ancient world, there's no doubt that scribes make scribal errors. Copied by human beings get tired, they get sleepy, they make mistakes, scribes aren't perfect, they're going to have their blunders. But when we talk about these thousands of changes, the thing that has to be decided between them is not just the quantity of changes, but the quality of changes. What kind of changes are these? The thing that Ehrman doesn't tell us in his book is that virtually 90% of the types of changes he's talking about are entirely irrelevant when it comes to establishing the original text of the New Testament. What kind of changes am I talking about? For one, misspellings. Turns out the scribes in the ancient world can't spell much better than people today when it comes to spelling words. So I have students in seminary that, believe it or not, even with spell check, still misspell words when they turn papers into me. Hard to believe. Well, in the ancient world, they didn't have spell check. In the ancient world, scribes would make copies of manuscripts, and they would misspell words. In fact, this is the most common mistake that we have in the ancient manuscripts, is they would misspell words, and this was incredibly common, because they'd often flip vowels around, they would add vowels, they'd leave them out, they would just make different types of errors, and the work would be different, just like you would make a mistake if you were writing a document. That makes up the vast types of changes we have here. Other types of changes include omissions of words, word order changes. In the Greek language, if you know anything about the Greek language, word order changes are virtually irrelevant because of the way Greek is inflected in terms of its nouns. These are the types of things that you need to recognize when it comes to these scribal changes. Ehrman doesn't really get into this, and that's one of the things he leaves out. There's a second thing, I think even more important, to help us understand the nature of these scribal changes and how we can really be sure that what we have was what was originally written by the authors when they wrote the New Testament. It simply has to do with the quantity of the manuscript we possess. Now imagine most of us don't think much about manuscripts. When you buy a book, you go down to your bookstore and you pull it off the shelf and it looks just like every other book on the shelf and you assume that it's printed up exactly the same. But in the ancient world, when you wanted to publish a book, what you did is you made copies of it. You had a scribe that made copies of it, and he did it by hand. He made thousands of these copies over time. Not just that one scribe, but throughout a book's publishing history, you have thousands of different copies made of this book. So when we have to establish whether we can trust the text of the book we have is what their author originally wrote, we, as historians, want to know how many copies of that book we have, and the more the better. The reason that numbers matter in this regard is a couple reasons. The more manuscripts I have, the more I can compare them to one another. So let's imagine, for example, that all I had were two manuscripts in the New Testament. Just two copies in ancient history. And let's imagine they differed. How would I know which one was the original text? That would be one of a problem, wouldn't it? Let's imagine that you have 200 manuscripts in the New Testament. Well, now that problem is diminished greatly, because whenever you have a change, you can trace it, you can track it, you can see how far back it goes, and you have more witnesses that can tell you what the original text is. So the more manuscripts, the better. There's another reason that lots of manuscripts are better, and it's simply this. The more manuscripts you have floating around, the more stable the textual tradition is. Give you another example. Let's imagine that you just have two copies of the Gospel of Luke in the ancient world. Let's imagine the church only had two copies of the Gospel of Luke for a moment. Let's imagine a person wanted to rewrite Luke and make it say what he wanted to say. And so he inserts into the textual tradition a third copy of Luke saying what he wants Luke to say. So now you have two of the original copies of Luke and now a third one that's been changed. Pretty good chance that that manuscript tradition may be altered by that third copy. But imagine that you have thousands of copies floating around. And someone makes his own copy as he wants it. Is that going to really change anything? Not at all. The more manuscripts you have, the more stable the textual tradition. Because any change that a person makes is just a singular change and can't really change the overall story. So, numbers matter when it comes to the copies of manuscripts. Ehrman doesn't talk about this. All he talks about is the number of variations, not the number of manuscripts. So how many manuscripts do we possess as New Testament scholars? Well, let me just give you some comparison numbers here. Some of you know anything about ancient history in the first century. You heard of a person by the name of Josephus, who's a very well-respected historian. We have 10 copies of his works. Tacitus, a very famous Roman historian about the first century BC, we have 3 copies of his particular works, some of them fragmentary. Gospel of Thomas, whom you've probably heard of, we really have 1 copy of Thomas in Coptic, a couple fragmentary copies in Greek. I can go on and on. The average number of copies of any document in antiquity, especially if it's over 1,000 years old, is probably around 20 copies. How does the New Testament fare in this regard? Well, the numbers are always changing because we're finding new manuscripts all the time, but the standing number right now is that we have over 5,700 copies, manuscripts, of the New Testament. Over 5,700. Now, what counts as a manuscript? Well, anything, obviously, before Gutenberg. Everybody counts manuscripts the same, by the way. So the same way you count the manuscripts of Josephus is the same way you count the manuscripts of the New Testament. They're not always complete. Some are fragmentary. We have over 5,700 of these. Now, that is an embarrassing amount of manuscripts. So much, in fact, that nothing in antiquity even really compares. What that does is that puts us in a very good place to reconstruct, if you will, what the original author said, that we can be virtually certain that the words we have are the words that were written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Paul, or whoever we want to mention. That's an enormous amount of manuscript evidence. But here's the other thing to note about it, is that the more manuscripts you find, guess what you're going to find along with them? More textual variations. And this is the thing that Ehrman leaves out completely in his discussion. All the while, he wants you to hear the number,
of textual variations. What he doesn't tell you is that the reason we have so many more textual variations in the New Testament is because we have so many more manuscripts of the New Testament. If we only had a couple manuscripts in the New Testament, we had very few textual variations. Now, since we have thousands and thousands and thousands of manuscripts, we have thousands and thousands of these little textual changes. And so you add them all up, it sounds like an overwhelming number. But it actually is a rather relevant number when you get right down to it, because it's a byproduct of very good things, namely lots of manuscripts. So, high amount of variations? Sure. Does it matter? No. It doesn't really change anything in terms of our ability to reconstruct what the original authors had to say. That leads us to a third objection tonight, as we make our way through the top five here. So we asked the question, can the New Testament or the Bible be trusted historically? The second objection was, has the Bible been changed along the way? The third question, or the third objection that comes up, is that the Bible contradicts itself. And these are probably, in the order of, at least my own experience, the top three objections that come on. And this is another objection that people bring up all the time. And they suggest, okay, fine, even if we grant these first two points, we actually possess what Matthew wrote, that Matthew had access to real historical information. The problem is, these documents don't agree, people will say. Particularly when it comes to the Gospels. There's contradictions. There's things that don't fit. They don't cohere with one another. They don't agree. You read one Gospel here, it says one thing, and you read another Gospel there, and it says another thing. How can we put these things together? Now, of course, tonight, in our short time, we don't have an opportunity to go through particularly apparent contradictions. I wish we did have that time. We don't. So what I'm going to do here in this third point is just give you some general thoughts on the way contradictions work and the way ancient historiography works. One of the main reasons that people think the Bible, particularly the Gospels, contradict themselves is because they don't understand the way ancient historiography operated. People in our day tend to take modern definitions of precision, modern definitions of the way we would do history if we were doing our own head, and they sort of put that on the Bible, and if it doesn't match, say, look, see, the Bible contradicts itself. But there's certain things about ancient historiography you have to know, and once you know this, so many of these apparent contradictions sort of dissolve into nothing. Let me mention some of these things for you tonight in this third objection. First thing to note is simply this. There has to be a distinction in our minds between differences and contradictions. This is a very key thing that people often don't separate. Simply because historical accounts are different doesn't make them contradictory. It's amazing how many times I get into conversations with folks, even other scholars, and this simple point, which is a fairly obvious one, is just missed. Simply because one gospel account tells a story that another gospel account doesn't tell is not a contradiction. For example, the only gospel account that we know of any childhood story of Jesus is the Gospel of Luke. In the early chapters of Luke, we have Jesus, a little boy in the temple. He's lost in the temple. Finally, his family goes back to get him in Jerusalem. There he is teaching the rulers there in that place. Only Luke reports that story for us. And so a big deal is made out of this, as if there's some sort of conflict because Matthew, John, and Mark don't tell us this story. But you have to realize that when it comes to reporting history, that is simply part and parcel of the way history is done. History is, by definition, limited. History is, by definition, selective. Why is that? Because you can't say everything, right? Can you imagine writing the history of someone and saying, I'm going to include everything? Well, you just can't do that. You can't say everything about somebody. You can't tell every story that happened to them. You can't give every quote from them. You can't report every angle of something. You can't say it all. What does that mean? Any given historian is always going to include some things, but another historian is not going to include. Moreover, he's going to include it from his perspective. He's going to give you his own angle on things, which is obviously going to be different than another person's angle. So the question isn't about differences. We have plenty of those in the Gospels. We have four different authors. The question is there really contradictions? Is there real meaningful historical things that can't be assimilated with one another? But in order to get to the bottom of that, we have to make a distinction between differences and contradictions. Second thing I'll say here under this point, this you need to understand about ancient historiography, is that exact quotations are not always used in the ancient world. You know, it's too bad in some ways that our New Testaments in English, at least, and I don't know about other languages, or what we call red-letter Bibles. Maybe you have one of these. So when you read your New Testament, and it's got the red letters, it's the words that Jesus said. They're in red letters. And, of course, in most English translations are actually in quotation marks. And that's fine for our use. And so, just realize, in the ancient world, It wasn't like a modern journalist who goes and gets a quote from President Obama or whatever the other leader they would get a quote from, and they stick a microphone in their face and hit record, and they get the exact wording. And if they don't get the exact wording, what happens? Their fellow journalists are going to get all over their case for it, right? You've got to give the quote exactly as it is. Now, how it was in the ancient world? In the ancient world, when you would want to record someone's teachings, it was very common that you would summarize them. It's very common that you paraphrase them. It's very common that you condense them. Now, if someone after my talk tonight paraphrased and tried to summarize what I had to say, and someone else tried to do the same thing, very small chance you would use the exact same words. Maybe you'd capture some of my exact words. Maybe you would summarize it and condense it. That's the little way that historiography was done. Now, why would people condense words in the ancient world? One of the major reasons they would condense words in the ancient world is they didn't have a lot of space. They had a limited number of papyri to write on. They couldn't include all those words in that one spot. So they weren't able always to get everything down. So condensing was just part of ancient history. Now, there's a last thing I'll mention here in terms of the way history is done, and that is it's not always recorded in chronological order. The other thing is people see in the gospel accounts, they see some stories in one order and some in a different order. Give me an example of this, Jesus' temptations. We have the temptations of Jesus in Matthew, we have the temptations of Jesus in Luke. There's three of them, but they're in different orders. You can go back and read tonight and see for yourself. Matthew has them in one order and Luke has them in a different order. And people say, well, see, here's a contradiction. You have to realize that in the ancient world, again, historiographically speaking, things were often linked in certain orders thematically. Stories were arranged in gospel accounts by theme and not always by strict chronological order. In fact, we see this very thing happen in the Gospel of Mark. Mark takes certain kinds of miracle stories and he likes to group them together as one sort of unit. And then he takes other kinds of stories and groups them together as a unit. He's not suggesting they all happen in that strict chronological order. Again, the way ancient history is done is not the same way that we necessarily would do it in the modern day. That doesn't mean it's inaccurate, or that it doesn't capture what it purports to capture. That leads us to the fourth objection tonight of these five. The fourth objection to the Bible that often comes up is that the Bible contains miracles. It's an issue of miracles. And you can imagine someone with this objection. They may think, okay, so you want me to take at face value and at his historical value a book that records people rising from the dead. You want me to believe in a book where Moses apparently parts the Red Sea. You want me to believe that people walk on water like Jesus. And you can imagine someone hearing this and thinking to themselves, no way am I going to believe a book that contains that. In fact, we all, in an enlightened day, know better than to believe in such things. Ever since the Enlightenment, we know that miracles aren't something that are worthy of our trust. And so people often object to the Bible as a book of history. It's one of their major objections to the Bible, that the Bible contains miracles. And since that is not sort of evidence of trustworthiness, the Bible ought to be rejected. Now, that actually has some rhetorical weight to it. When you hear people talk like that, often in your own mind, you might think to yourself, hold on a second, maybe it is kind of silly to believe that someone could rise from the dead. Maybe it is kind of silly to think that the Red Sea really parted and the Israelites walked through dry land. Maybe believing in miracles doesn't make any sense at all. However, the objection to the Bible on the basis of miracles doesn't sound as compelling as it does at first when you start breaking it down. Let me explain what I mean by this. One of the fundamental flaws of this objection when it comes to the Bible is simply this, that it assumes what is yet to be proven. I'll say that again. It assumes what is yet to be proven. You see, if someone believes that the Bible is not true because it contains miracles, they're actually rejecting the Bible on the basis of a prior belief, a prior conviction that they have before they even enter into the discussion about the Bible, and that prior belief is that miracles are impossible. So if someone says the Bible contains miracles, therefore I reject it, that's based on a prior belief that they already have. That prior belief is that miracles are in fact impossible. But that prior belief itself has to be justified. It can't just be assumed from the outset. It can't just simply be used. It has to actually be demonstrated. It has to actually be shown that miracles are impossible. In fact, this happens all the time in discussion. People don't know they're actually bringing this to bear on the discussion. They don't realize that. And so someone looks at the Bible and says, that doesn't fit with my own naturalistic view of the world, so therefore I'm going to reject it. But they don't realize that the very question in play is whether the naturalistic view of the world or the supernaturalistic view of the world is the right view. So you can't just assume that you're viewed from the outset and then reject the Bible on those grounds. In other words, whether miracles are impossible or not has to actually be demonstrated. Now, can that be? Well, some will say yes. In fact, some have tried to say that, in fact, it's been demonstrated by modern science. In fact, you may have even heard people argue this way in discussions with them yourself, saying something along the lines of that modern science has shown that miracles are impossible. Now, although that might be something that is rhetorically common in people's language, scientifically speaking, that's simply not been done. Let me explain why. The philosophers of science recognize this. How could you show that miracles are impossible on scientific terms? Well, to show that on scientific terms, you'd have to actually go around and witness every particular event in the world to know that it only has a natural cause. You have to actually be able to empirically observe all the events in the world, not to mention the present ones, but even the ones in the past, to show that their cause is only a natural cause, and not a supernatural cause. But there's no possible way that any scientist could empirically make all that observation. He could not be everywhere in the world at once, and to observe all these different individual events, to know that all of them are caused only by natural causes and not by supernatural causes, and then ruling out miracles as a possibility entirely. In fact, the only way you could do that is if you actually had some sort of omniscient knowledge. In fact, the only way you could rule out miracles is if you had sort of knowledge like God had knowledge, ironically. You almost have to have knowledge like God had in order to rule out miracles in the first place. So what happens then is that miracles and their impossibility is in fact not something you can show from science. It's not empirically demonstrable in science. Scientists hold this view all the time, that miracles are impossible. But here's the thing, that's not a scientific view, even if a scientist holds it. Actually, it's a philosophical commitment that needs to be demonstrated, and I think has a hard time being so. It is ironic, is it not, that a scientist so committed to science that he will reject Christianity on those grounds, actually has within his own system a non-scientific premise that cannot be shown by science at all, namely that miracles are impossible. It's simply a philosophical belief brought to the table. Now, this particular dilemma is well known to philosophers, and in fact, they often talk about this insistence from scientists to only assume, or to assume, that all causes have a natural foundation to them. In fact, you may have heard of a very famous philosopher by the name of Alvin Plantinga from Notre Dame. He commented on this rather humorously, and I'll read the quote to you. He talks about this idea that miracles are impossible because science only deals with natural causes. This is what he says. He says, this argument, that miracles are impossible because they're only due to natural causes, he says, this argument is like the drunk who insisted on looking for his lost car keys under the streetlight on the grounds that the light was better there. And he says, goes on to say this, in fact, it would go the drunk one better, would insist that because the keys would be hard to find in the dark, they must be under the light. Now, this is an example of what goes on in natural science, is to assume that all causes have to be empirically observable natural causes, is in fact to do exactly what Plantinga says, is to assume, in one sense, the keys have to be under the light because that's the best place for them to be found. As a result of this particular dilemma, most objections to miracles at the end of the day turn out to be rather circular. In fact, you can sort of just pick this up in sort of normal conversation with folks in terms of the circularity of miracles. Usually if you ask someone, do you believe in miracles? Or rather, if you ask someone why they think miracles are impossible, usually they'll say, because I've never seen one. And then you say, well, what about all the people who have seen one? And then the answer is, well, they're all mistaken. And then you ask the question, well, how do you know all these people who claim to see miracles are mistaken? And the answer is, because miracles are impossible. So wherever you started from, you end up back to where you began at the very beginning. Now, what I think helps frame this question is the objection to miracles, I think, just misses a very simple reality. Is that if God really exists, if he really is there, then the idea of a miracle is not at all an odd thing. If God really created the world, controls the world, and sovereignly oversees it, and oversees the natural laws in it, God can intervene in the world at any point, at any time, any way he wishes. And so on a theistic view of the world, miracles are eminently reasonable. In other words, to object against miracles is almost to object against the existence of God. It would have to be. You'd have to make the same objection. To show that miracles are in fact a possibility, you have to show that God's existence is an impossibility, which is itself a very difficult thing to show. In fact, arguably impossible to show a universal negative in that regard. What this means, then, is in a theistic view of the world, miracles are not something that at all should keep us from the Bible. Let's say this is the last of the five tonight. And one that I think also comes up a good bit in terms of objections, and it's simply this. The Bible is immoral and offensive. This is the fifth and final objection that I hear from people all the time. The Bible is immoral and offensive. This is a little bit of a different objection, think about it. It's not so much an historical one. not saying that whether Matthew wrote Matthew or whether you can trust the transmission of these texts or whether miracles and so forth. It's an objection that goes something like this. I find the God of the Bible morally repugnant. Or someone might say, you know, I find the teaching of the Bible offensive to my own sense of morality and decency. Or someone might look at God of the Bible and say, I see that the God of the Bible judges people for their sin, and if God judges for the people for their sin, then no God I would believe in would ever do such a thing, because that's a bad thing to do. God shouldn't do that, and I don't like the fact that God does that, therefore I'm not going to accept the Bible. In fact, this is often the kind of objection that comes up in Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. I mentioned him earlier. I read you a quote by Dawkins. He doesn't hold back here. This is what he has to say about his opinion of the God of the Bible. He says this about God. He refers to him as a jealous, unjust, petty, unforgiving, control freak, bloodthirsty, misogynistic, racist, capriciously malevolent bully. And then he goes on finally to say that he finds God to be morally obnoxious. Now, that type of objection is more common than you might think. It's an objection on the basis of moral offense. Now, although rhetorically, again, you hear Dawkins, you think, wow, that seems to have some persuasion that God's this way and we ought to sort of rise up against him. The moral objection to God has a whole host of its own problems. And let me explain what they are. The heart of this problem is simply this. I want you to notice what the objection is saying and is not saying. I want you to notice that this particular objection is not simply saying that a person personally doesn't prefer God. It's not just simply saying that a person privately wishes God were different. It's not just simply an objection that's saying, I personally don't like God. Rather, it's an objection that's saying there's some sort of standard out there in the world. There's some sort of norm in the world that God is failing to meet, that God is not living up to, that God is, in fact, violating, or that the teachings of the Bible, in fact, violate. In fact, it's a way of saying that God ought to be one way, and God ought to not be another way, and that there's some sort of ought out there that we're all aware of and can agree to that God isn't matching up to. Of course, whenever this argument is laid forth, questions arise, particularly for Dawkins. We want to ask Dawkins this question. If, in fact, your objection to God requires some sort of moral norm that God is violating, where do you get these moral norms in your own worldview? And for Dawkins, who's an atheist, this becomes particularly problematic. How in the world does Dawkins, as an atheist, establish moral norms in his own system? How is it in an atheist system where it's just matter in motion and rocks and trees and one bag of molecules bumping into another bag of molecules have anything to do with moral norms at all? How does the existence of matter create moral obligations that are universal and absolute and should be followed by everybody? How does it do such a thing? Why should Dawkins have any care at all what one person, one animal, does to another animal in an atheistic system? The whole concept of moral norms or absolutes in an atheistic world completely disintegrates because there's nothing in an atheistic world that ever warrants such a thing. In an atheistic world, things are just are the way they are. It just is. There's no ought. It just is. Now, of course, Dawkins could backtrack here. One of the things that Dawkins could do at this point, or any atheist for that matter, is he could say, oh, I don't mean to say there's actually moral norms in the world. I just mean that the God of the Bible personally offends me. I just mean personally I don't like the God of the Bible. But of course, if he does this, then he reaches another problem, because whether Richard Dawkins likes or doesn't like something has nothing to do with whether it exists. Whether he personally likes God or doesn't like God has no bearing on the truthfulness of God. Personally not liking something doesn't make it go away or appear. His personal preferences are not an argument. Not liking something is not an argument. In other words, for Dawkins' argument against God on the grounds of morality to work, he actually has to have moral absolutes for it to work. But his own atheistic worldview destroys the very moral absolutes he needs in order to make the objection to God in the first place. So Dawkins finds himself, as any atheist would, in a very precarious position if he's going to object to the Bible or to God on moral grounds. Because in order to object to God on moral grounds, he needs his own set. Where do they come from? And if he says there are no moral grounds, then his objection to God is not taken away. In fact, one might say that for Dawkins to object to God, he actually has to assume God is around to provide moral norms in order to object to him. He almost has to presuppose God's existence in order to say God doesn't exist. Now, a very famous atheist ran into the same problem by the name of C.S. Lewis, who didn't stay in atheist, as you probably know. He said this. Here's a quote from his own sort of attestant to this dilemma. He said this: "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not that it simply did not happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple." Now, where does that leave us with the moral objection of the Bible? Well, that leaves us simply this: in order to make a moral objection of the Bible, the people are free to do it, is that they have to have some grounds in their own system for making that moral claim. And so that's the challenge that comes up. And at least for the atheist at this point, like Dawkins, he has no grounds in his system at all to make such a claim. Okay, so there's five objections to the Bible we've seen. Number one, is the Bible historically reliable? We said, well, at least the Gospels, we'll take that narrow question. We have good reasons to think those get back to history. Second, we asked the question whether they've been transmitted accurately. And we think not only from type of changes we have, but the number of manuscripts we possess, we have a very good reason to think they have. Third, does the Bible contradict itself? We think no when we look at the historiographical evidence. Number four, what about miracles? We saw that the argument against miracles simply is a faith commitment of its own. And then lastly, moral objections to the Bible. You actually need God to establish morality in order to object to it. At the very beginning of our time tonight, I cited, if you even remember, Voltaire, one of the Enlightenment philosophers. He said the Bible would disappear in his own generation. There was another person that mentioned this. Her name was Corrie ten Boom. You may know the name Corrie ten Boom. She was a Holocaust survivor, a committed Christian who suffered under the Nazis. It's interesting, she talked later about Voltaire. She said this: "Voltaire expected that within 50 years of his lifetime there would not be one Bible in the world. His house is now a distribution center for Bibles in many languages." That's interesting. The Bible has just proved itself to be a rather special book. Even though some have opposed it over time, it's found its way. I would argue that that is due not that it just happens to be a compelling human book, but it actually, I think, is because it happens to be a divine book. Thank you. I know that Phil had mentioned maybe taking some time for questions, which I would enjoy doing. So, Phil, should I open it up to the floor?
Yeah, you
go. Okay, so just fire away, raise your hand, let me know, and we'll be happy to take questions. It could be on any of the things I've discussed, any of the 5 points, or maybe there's another question that you have on your mind that's related to this more broadly. We'd be happy to hear that. Questions? Yes.
I'll start one. I've heard people say before that claiming that the Gospels were first century documents wasn't actually, or I've heard people argue that really it was more of a third century piece. The Gospels, like, that we have a real reliable copy of the Gospels. Can you maybe comment on that?
Okay, so you're not talking about the dating of the Gospels, but the earliest copy.
Yeah,
the
earliest copy.
Yeah. This goes back to the textual transmission issue. I would say, arguably, that's not the case, and here's why. One, we have a number of copies of the Gospels from the 2nd century that need to be noted. I mean, one of the most famous in this regard is a manuscript by the name of P52. This is his papyrus number 52, which is a copy of the Gospel of John, which dates actually the early 2nd century. We also have many that date towards the end of the 2nd century. Another copy of John, almost a full copy, P66, which is probably arguably 170 or 180. You have to realize that John's Gospel is probably written around 80 or 90 AD, depending on how people date it. And our earliest copies, P52, is right around 125. Now it's about a 30 or 40 year gap. Now in our minds, we think it sounds like a lot. But historiographically, it is so small, I can't even begin to tell you. Our normal gap of time between when documents were written or earliest copies is usually about 1,000 years. So I mentioned Josephus earlier. His book's written in the 1st century. Our earliest copy is actually 10th century for his book Antiquities, which is 1,000 years. I don't hear many people talking about the unreliability of Josephus' text. So one part of the answer is we have a lot of gospel copies from the 2nd century. The other way to answer the question is the way manuscripts work. In other words, let's imagine that we have these copies from the 2nd and 3rd century, and we can reconstruct the text on those grounds. Someone can say this, they can say, yeah, but you don't have 1st century copies. And so you don't have 1st century copies, you can never know. But see, here's the problem. If 1st century copies existed that are radically different than our own copies, then we have to believe that they never survived. Not only did they never survive, but no one ever made copies of them, they made their way into our current textual tradition. And that's a very difficult thing to swallow historically.
In other words, what you have to ask is it reasonable to think that by the second, third century, we have a fairly wide grasp of what the text looked like at that time? And if someone says yes, which I think most historians would agree to, then to believe that it was radically different only 50 years earlier, but that doesn't show up in our current textual tradition, the only way you could have that is you had an intentional recension by some ecclesiastical body that weeded out everything. There's no structures in early Christianity for that. So it just doesn't hold up in that regard. Good question. Other questions? It can be about the New Testament, textual transmission. Yes?
Well, first of all, thanks again for coming.
You bet.
Mine's kind of a broad question here.
Okay.
It's thinking like C.S. Lewis's idea, you know, going from the indicative to the imperative kind of is to all.
Sure.
And nowadays, the atheist, I think probably what I encounter most often here is probably number three, the contribution to maybe number five, morality.
Mm-hmm.
What are some like practical ways of dealing with this ultimate heart commitment that they have, these naturalistic tendencies, like when you're coming from the scripture? Because when they're not typical, the new type of atheists, they really are. Like Christopher Hitchens is just angry, and Dawkins is too. I mean, like,
yeah.
We're trying to deal with it in a way of being obedient to the scripture. You know, 1 Peter 3:15. Are there some practical ways we can do like apologetics and dealing with it, like their animosity by, you know, showing consistency or showing?
Yeah, them? Yeah. The new atheism is a tricky thing. I mean, there's a whole number of folks out. Hitchens and Dawkins are key examples of this that have written sort of resurgent ideas about atheism. What I found different, though, with the new atheism, this is where I think you can get some mileage here, is the new atheism isn't like the old atheism. The old atheism, we think of Bertrand Russell and guys like that, are going to be typically more sort of philosophically oriented arguments. So they're going to be sort of syllogisms and the like, where you're going to say, you know, this, that, and the other proves God doesn't exist because of these type of things. Modern atheism, or the new atheism, is much more sort of emotionally driven, and they're much more angry. I think your word was right. I mean, Dawkins looks like he just was ticked off one night, sat down at the computer, just kind of, you know, went to town. What I think is the best method with that is they're not really arguing philosophy, they're arguing with moral outrage. They're really angry. They think that people who believe in God have committed atrocities. This is particularly along the lines of Hitchens and others, God is Not Great, his book. But it also is not just the Christians who have committed moral atrocities, but the Christians themselves are believe things that are morally reprehensible, and that God himself has committed morally reprehensible things in the Bible. There's a lot of angst there. There's a lot of pent-up anger. What I think the best thing to do is somewhat, if I tried to do tonight, is to sort of harness the moral outrage and turn it back on them. Remember, it's not a philosophical argument, it's a moral argument. Turn it back on them and say, hey, I'm hearing the moral outrage. You're upset about the Crusades. You're upset about other things. Actually, you know, ironically, the Bible actually has a reason, too, to be upset about that. Christians don't always live consistently with their own witness. But I, as a Christian, have a reason for being morally upset about some of these things, but you don't seem to, but you are. What does that say? You have a world that, in one sense, destroys any grounds for moral norms, but yet you still find yourself morally outraged. What does that suggest? I'm going to tell my atheist friends that suggests you're made in the image of God, and that you know these things are right, and you know some things are wrong, and it's reflected on your conscience. And so he still is going to live like moral norms matter, even though his own worldview undercuts it. I think that's where we want to go time and time again, to show that disconnect, that their lives don't match their philosophy in a very poignant way. And it's not just because they're living inconsistently with them, it's because you can't live consistently with them. You can't live out an atheistic world consistently, because you realize...
Yes. That's great. What about... I think you answered exactly what I need.
Mm-hmm.
What about this kind of maybe Lewis's argument from desire to basing it is? How do you think that plays upon like they're struggling with the inconsistency of their own heart? They realize, okay, I'm really mad at this or angry at this, but now you're telling me I don't have a reason. Now I maybe realize that, but my heart is the problem, and the reason is maybe not what's working together, this kind of integration between the head and the heart, and then struggling to find the truth. I mean, how would the argument...
Yeah, what I would argue at that point is that their inclinations to be more outraged at certain things are correct, but their own worldview gives no basis for it. And so what I would then is try to steer them to Christianity and say, look, we have a basis for it, we have intellectual grounds for it, we can make that claim. You use the term desire, I'm not sure exactly, you know, what part of Lewis's work you're referring to, that maybe mere Christianity. But I think that plays into what as well, which is there seems to be some sense within us of right and wrong, and you have to explain that. Now, Dawkins has his own naturalistic explanation for it. We can come back to that in a point if it comes up. Yep.
I think in some of the outflow of this, is it comes to a question that I've been kind of asking myself a lot and pondering. I feel a lot of the discussions that I get in now with people are outcomes-based arguments. Their complaint about Christianity has nothing to do with necessarily the ration that we can use to express the
pragmatic
truth, but I don't want to look like all those Christians.
Yes, yep, that's right.
How do you respond in that? Because that's not a philosophical, it is a moral thing.
But. Yes, so people often object to Christianity on the basis of Christians themselves, and this is true. And you know that should sort of wake us all up if we're Christians to how we live our lives. I think though it's a fundamental misunderstanding of Christianity. Maybe this is maybe part of the argument we can make to them is that we can say, look, if your reason for believing in Christianity is based on Christians alone, then you're not looking towards the right source for why you should believe in Christianity. The place we want to direct people for the grounds, if you will, for their faith is Christ Himself, which of course being perfect has no flaws that we're going to find. So in that regard, I think that they fundamentally misunderstood what Christianity is pointing them to and ought to look to Christ. The other thing I would say, though, is that I would challenge them a little bit on the same grounds I was going through here, is that, so are you morally upset by how Christians are behaving? Let me understand this, because if you are, then tell me about where you get moral norms from in your system. And I would go that way. Mm-hmm. The third thing I would say is also Christianity itself gives an explanation for Christians' misbehaving. See, this is the thing that I think needs to be pointed out. He almost pretends that the Bible says Christians will always behave correctly, and then we're actually going against our own religion. Actually, if you read the Bible, it's surely the opposite. The Bible says that there's something called original sin in us. It doesn't go away completely in this life, and it always sort of rears its ugly head, even for Christians, and comes out. In fact, the Bible has tremendous evidence that it gives account to ongoing struggles in the Christian life if they don't live correctly, whether it be King David with Bathsheba or modern Christians, etc. And so we actually have built into our system an explanation for why we behave the way we do. Why are we mixes between good and bad? Christianity has an answer for that. If he's an atheist you're talking to, you could say, tell me why you think people have a mix between good and bad. I have an answer in our worldview for why people behave morally great sometimes and morally reprehensible other times. And that's very consistent with our faith. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, I guess from a different angle in dealing with textual criticism, that we have source documents in the Old Testament, four source hypothesis, Deuterotrichos, Isaiah. In the New Testament, people will confront you with, let's say, Mark and Q.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And what's your response to that?
Yeah.
Source and Mark, especially, and also in the context of some of the epistles, where it would be held, they were Andreana, in other words, not in the framework and source as a theologian issue.
Okay, yeah, so you threw out a lot there. Good job packing it all in one question. I
did the Mark because you're dealing with gospels.
Yeah, thank you. We'll split that up.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned JVP first.
Didn't want to get into that.
Yeah, okay.
Two source.
Well, if you're interested in the two source hypothesis.
Same thing.
Okay, same idea. So, well, they're actually very different. Let me explain why. With JVP, which is called the documentary hypothesis, for those of you who don't know, suggests that Moses did not have anything to do with the Pentateuch, did not write Genesis, and it's just a patchwork of different authors over time. That's actually been largely refuted in modern day, even amongst Old Testament scholars in the secular world, and so it's not many people holding on to that. There's a few. You mentioned Q. This is a little bit different, because Q is a hypothetical source that our Gospels might have used. And I'm not particularly convinced of Q as a historical source, and there's many in the scholarly world now that doubt it. Mark Goodacre is a good example of this and others. In fact, that is catching on. It's almost now become the anti-Q world is almost as popular as the Q world. But whichever way you come out on using Q or not, or whether you think Q is a historical source or not, it's a different question than the documentary hypothesis, because the idea that gospel writers use sources isn't at all a problem, I don't think. And let me explain why. When we have Luke sitting down to write his gospel, sometimes we have this idea that Luke sat down, got out a bunch of papyrus, and dipped his pen in the ink and said, okay, I've got about 6 hours to write this thing. Here we go. And he started writing. Well, actually, Luke tells us that's not how he wrote it. Luke tells us he investigated all these things. He would talk about other Gospels. In fact, he talks about many others. There are many other Gospels, poikiloi there in the Greek, floating around that day that he sourced and so forth. And so the idea that Gospel writers would use sources, would do their investigations, and then write their account is entirely fine. And maybe one of those sources was Q.
No, no. I find Q's involved in other accounts.
But I don't have a theological objection with Q.
Yeah,
exactly. So in that regard, I think the idea that authors use Q, or that the authors use some source, is fine. We know this from the Old Testament in a good way to use sources, because the authors tell us. I think about Joshua 10, when the sun stood still. It says, the story of the sun standing still says, as was written in the book of Joshua. Have you read the book of Joshua? Anyone know what that is? No, it's clear they had some source. The Kings and Chronicles talk about the annals of the kings of Judah. So using sources isn't a problem. But I think the documentary hypothesis is a different thing. Now, you tacked a third question in there, and I'm forgetting it now.
That was with respect to the epistles and the...
Pseudonymous?
Yeah, right.
Yes, okay, so...
Pseudepigraphy.
Yeah, so if you're tracking with the question here, there's discussions about whether some of the letters in the New Testament are written by the people that purport to be written by. Whether it be 2 Peter is one example, right. Did Peter write it, did Paul write the pastoral epistles, and so forth. It's a fairly lengthy discussion we can get into here. I think that there's a number of problems with a lot of the methodology used to try to show non-Pauline authorship or non-Petrine authorship, particularly the idea of just comparing your writings and saying a number of vocabulary are different from the prior letter, and therefore the same author could not have written these. I don't know about you, but if I took something you wrote 20 years ago and compared it to something you wrote today and tried to match vocab and style and then try to prove you didn't write it, I don't know what kind of conclusion we'd reach, but I imagine many people's writing styles change over the years and also change for the different purposes they like. So I find those arguments not as compelling as some. Other questions? Yes?
I like what you had to say about the problem with the moral objections to God from the atheist standpoint and not living up to standards of morality that they're setting.
Sure.
But what would you say if Dawkins tried to turn that away, turn that around and said, okay, I'll throw out my right to assign morality for my atheistic belief, but I want to look at your belief or the Christian belief and what you believe morally about God.
Sure.
Such as omniscience, perfect benevolence, and all those sort of things, and say, I look at the world. And based on the moral standard that you say that God lives up to, I don't see this world morally fitting into what a perfect.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so your question then is really a little bit along the lines of it's an objection not on the basis of Dawkins' own conception of morality, but rather it's an internal Christian problem. How do Christians explain evil in the world if God is good?
Yeah,
I mean, it's really the question you're asking. Or why is it if God is as good as the Bible says, there's evil in the world? Am I restating your question?
Yes, fact that not based on his moral.
Sure. In other words, does the world as we see it comport with the God the Bible describes and the Bible itself, what it teaches?
Yeah.
Well, obviously, the whole problem with evil questions are almost one we can't unpack fully. I will say this: and I actually don't know how much Dawkins has read the Bible. Because when he makes his arguments, it doesn't seem like he's aware of certain things. But actually, the Bible explains the origin of evil and why there's wickedness in the world, and why the world looks the way it does, in a fairly compelling way, in terms of the way the fall happened, the way the world was cursed, and how sin is rampant, the world destroying it, and how Christ has come to redeem the world, and rolling that back will not be complete until the final consummation. That scenario actually explains quite well why the world looks the way it does. And now he can say, I don't like that, but not liking it, again, is an argument. He has to have something from his system that objects. I think the internal coherence of Christianity in that sense is quite good. I don't think he's actually looked at the totality of the biblical witness to understand that. You have to understand theological doctrines to understand that. You understand concepts like the fall and sin and redemption and things like this. And I think he's missed some of that. So it's a fair question to ask. And I think our answer is, I think the Bible itself is its reason to understand the world looks the way it does for certain reasons, and the Bible explains those reasons. Other questions? Yes?
I just wanted to ask if you could recommend any books that deal with the topic that you talked about.
Yeah, which one, right? So many different topics, good books. Well, there's a very good book by Tim Keller out now that you may have heard of called The Reason for God. This book, I think, gives a good overview of why we believe in God and deals with a number of the moral arguments I've touched on here. That's probably a good place to start. If you're looking for discussions of the origins of the New Testament and the origins of the Bible and so forth, wow, there's so many different ones to get at here. I'd probably just become bibliographical, spreading off here. So if you don't mind, come to me afterwards. I'll give you a few titles to suggest. So. Other questions, whether it be about the New Testament or morality or et cetera. Okay.
Do you have to convince your students of these things?
Which parts?
The authenticity of the New Testament, looking at the Moses.
If you understand anything about RTS, most of the people who show up to be trained there already have a lot of these things ahead of time. So, but we do get people who just are struggling with their own doubts. And, maybe that's some of you here. Maybe you're here and maybe you're, a Christian and a believer, but you have your own doubts, not because you're trying to be a skeptic, because you just maybe never heard answers to these things before. So we have students like that show up. And when they do, we try to encourage them as best we can. There's little historical things to get behind, but we try to take them rigorously into the sources and primary sources and original languages to try to show them that these things cohere together. So, yes?
I heard you mention word contradiction on three, and you used the word apparent.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this is a position there. I'm wondering, how would I explain to some people, maybe it's their internal critique, that when I'm looking at it and something seems maybe not to corroborate, it's maybe similar to the scientific, or you're just giving an explanation, and maybe in the future, of course, more information will compare. Or is it a paradox? Is it an apparent contradiction? Or how is it working out? And I see something Matthew says, and Luke says, and it doesn't seem from my understanding.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. And when I use the term apparent contradiction, the reason I use that term is because I think a lot of contradictions may seem on the surface at first glance like they're contradictions. But then actually, when you start unpacking them, they turn out to be simply apparent contradictions. And this is common at any time you hear just parts of the story. If you hear one person give an account, and you have another person give an account, and these get little slivers that may look at first glance like those couldn't agree. But then you realize, oh, there's a third thing here I never knew about that explains that. That type of thing actually comes up a lot in the Gospels. I can give you some examples of this. One of the classic examples of a Gospel contradiction is that Jesus was crucified on two different days. John has Jesus crucified on Thursday, and the Synoptic Gospels have Jesus crucified on Friday. This is a standard one. Now, if you look really quick at one of the statements in John's Gospel, that Jesus is crucified on the day of preparation, and you took that as the day of preparation for the Passover instead of the day of preparation for the Sabbath, you could think that they were right. But the term day of preparation is almost always used for the Sabbath, which is on a Saturday, showing that John, in fact, had Jesus crucified on a Friday like everybody else. That's just a quick example of what I'm talking about. To resolve contradictions, you have to have certain historical information. You have to know how ancient historiography works, and you have to spend some time in the text. My point is simply this, is that too often people's readings of the Bible are very cursory. They read them very quickly, they don't understand the way ancient sources worked, and they just simply at a first glance take a quick look at things. I think when you get down deeper, you see that these things often resolve themselves. Are there times in the Bible where you look at things and you're like, I'm not seeing the resolution? Of course. And, part of that is trusting God and the way he reveals his word. I can always understand everything about Scripture, and some parts of Scripture are difficult to understand, no doubt about that.
Chapter one more.
Maybe. One more? Anyone want to fire in the last question? You have three more for me?
No. I just wanted to say, in my line of work, I deal apologetically with professors in the schools in Eastern Europe,
and
Western Europe, and a lot of the arguments that you started out with, especially 1 through 3,
mm-hmm.
are very prevalently being taught in the schools of theology in Germany, Slovakia, Prague, what have you.
And
you have
sex.
Don't even get me wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the thing that is my prayer, I guess, just from my area and my work, is that that there's a tremendous need in it, not only for us as Christians to be able to defend our faith with the people that are moving atheistically, but in the schools of theology, to raise up schools here that do hold to a solid posture of Scripture,
mm-hmm.
and train pastors that come out that have a good solid biblical framework, and that is just so rare.
In
Eastern and Western Europe.
That's right.
There's different schools of thought in Germany and the Leipzig school and things like that.
Well, on that score, maybe I'll leave y'all a final thought here. From the idea of defending the faith, apologetics, and interacting with non-Christians, I'll leave you this final thought, and this wasn't designed to be a new methodology of apologetics. But I will say this, is that too often in our discussion with folks that are skeptical of the faith, I think we too often take the posture of simply answering questions, even though that's not what I was doing. But you'll notice that when I did it, I also turned it around and made the non-Christian also account for their worldview. And that is, I think, a parting thought I'll leave with you, is that if you interact with skeptics in the faith, and maybe you're a skeptic yourself, you want to realize that the only people that need to be given answers to things are not just Christianity. Anybody who comes to the table and says, I have a worldview that makes sense of reality, has to answer these tough questions. And so it's not just Christians that have to give answers. Everyone has to give answers. And so as you talk with your non-Christian friends, they have to give answers too, for where moral norms come from and things like this, not just Christianity. Okay, we'll take that as the last question.